Hey, feminist frequency radio heads, we did it! Actually, you did it. We set an ambitious goal for our May fundraising drive, and thanks to your generosity, we reached it. In these frightening, frustrating, feckless times, you took a look at the horrifying rhetoric that's gaining ground against women and gender nonconforming folks, disabled folks, trans folks, people of color, undocumented folks, and you said, I'm going to put my money where my mouth is. I'm going to support the amplification of progressive voices that shed light on the crucial issues facing these populations, and I'm going to help fund the creation of the kind of media I want to see, read, and listen to. On behalf of all of us at Feminist Frequency, thank you. JC, John Connor,
that's
Jesus
right.
Christ, James Cameron.
Oh my God, Carol. Welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is episode 29. You can relax into your easy chairs, folks, because I have one of the grown-ups back in the mix with me today. Everyone, give it up for Carolyn Pettit.
Hey, everyone.
This is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love, or alternatively, we're the feminist killjoys coming for your medias, depending upon your perspective. In today's show, we're going to be talking about Solo, the latest entry into the incessant Star Wars franchise, and then we're going to moonwalk into Vintageville for a discussion of another franchise with a body that just won't quit, The Terminator. In subsequent episodes of Feminist Frequency Radio, we're going to tackle some of the expansions of that universe, but this week, Carol and I are going to chop it up about the 1984 originator, The Terminator.
Yeah, the Terminator.
Exactly,
right?
The Terminator.
The others might be a Terminator, but the one that Schwarzenegger plays in this one is the Terminator.
Exactly. Not the T-800, not the T-1000, not Genesis, whatever. We're going to get into where it all began.
Yes.
As always, we're going to finish the show by both sharing a little something in What's Your Freak Out? As you probably know, I still call this segment What's Your Deal in My Head, so forgive me, Anita, if I trip up and call it that later. Exclusively for our fantastic drip backers, this week's bonus is going to be something special. It might be, you know, an expansion of our discussion of Terminator. It might be reading a little bit of my obtuse, circuitous, poorly argued dissertation about American body culture and Arnold Schwarzenegger. It might be something else entirely.
Hell yeah, let's get academic as fuck up in here.
Woo! What is Drip, you ask? Well, it is a subscription-based membership platform, and your generous support is what helps us keep making this podcast. If you want access to special perks, like my dissertation, and exclusive backer rewards, join our podcast community at d.rip/femfreak. Now, on with the show. Carolyn, I am so happy to have you back.
I'm happy to be back, but let me just share with the audience a little bit of my current state. I feel this morning, I think that I'm starting to return to the land of the living. That might be premature. It's still, the day is still young, but so I went, the week before last, I went to Sweden and Denmark for a whirlwind trip, just 4 days, and then had to come right back. And while I was there, I drank so much coffee to compensate for the time difference that I think I set my system into some kind of like extra levels of fatigue above and beyond what you get from
normal
jet lag.
Well, hadn't you just recently weaned yourself off coffee?
Oh, that's a constant battle for me, Ebony. I mean, that is just that as I am consistently either in the process of getting off the wagon or getting back on the wagon. It's just a never-ending thing for me. But in Sweden, you'll be interested to know that there are these places called Espresso House, which is like basically
I love it already.
It's basically the Starbucks of at least those parts of Sweden and Denmark that I was in, because I mean almost literally, this is just the slightest amount of hyperbole, that I could basically see each subsequent Espresso House from the windows of whichever Espresso House I was currently in. Like, they have a market saturation there that is like unbelievable.
I love it. I love it. Yeah. You know, my greatest fear, if there's ever like a zombie apocalypse or like, you know, a biohazard, like decimates the population and we have to rebuild society, is that I won't have access to caffeine when I need it. Like, I honestly, when I say that I want to die in the first wave, it's because I don't want to wake up one morning and not have a cup of coffee. It's not worth it to me.
Yeah. Life is not worth living anymore. All right. Well,
did you have any things that occurred to you in Sweden? Like, huh, the way that Anita always comes back with like, hey, I saw this funny thing in Sweden, you know, or like this wonderful thing happened. I will say people know from like a couple of episodes ago that I asked folks to write in specifically if they had info about the haunted Swedish metro station. I got the information too late to share with you. Apparently it does exist. So if you plan on going back, which I assume you will, like, because you had a great time at Nordic Games Fest, the people love you. I gotta get you in that famous last words, right? I'm gonna send you to this place. You're gonna have like a GoPro camera on your head, and that'll be the last we see of Carolyn, and I'll have to live with the
guilt. Blair Witch footage style footage from that is gonna go so viral, and I will never be seen again.
Anita is gonna kill me if I'm responsible for your don't do that to me, Carolyn. Don't go.
Okay. All right.
Hit me up with what's going on in pop culture.
Speaking of people going or not going, smooth segue there. Roseanne has been sent packing by ABC after such a heinous racist tweet that she sent last Tuesday. So, you know, one of the things that that I found so fascinating about the cancellation of Roseanne was that in the immediate wake of it on social media, there were all these like right wingers who were kind of like calling, you know, throwing around the term like double standard and pushing to have, you know, the great champion of the left, Bill Maher, also fired for his like inappropriate comments or whatever. And so many of us on the left are like, no, don't come for Bill Maher, please.
Oh, God. It was hilarious because you can just imagine the way that those folks were like happy slapping their keyboards thinking they had dunked on the left by saying, oh, well, if you take away our champion, then we're going to take away yours, in the way that like progressive folks were like, okay, you may have him, sir. We do not care.
Yeah. I mean, but the whole situation, I think, really illuminates how, I mean, everyone knew when they got involved in this project, ABC knew when they picked it up, who Roseanne was nowadays, right? And it was not like, there was like a tweet I saw that was something like, oh, you know, Roseanne went from being, just racist enough to like have a TV show to saying something that made her just slightly too racist to have a TV show or whatever. It's not like they didn't know who they were, you know, getting in bed with, quote unquote, you know, when working on this. So I'm glad that they canceled the show in response to this, but it's also like, you know, you were just hoping she wouldn't say anything like this. It's not like you thought she was like above this or better than this.
Right. Or you were hoping that she would continue to express herself in this way, but that it would fall upon, you know, more receptive ground. Right.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah,
you know, her, you know, self donned robes as, you know, like a speaker to power, you know, as like this outsider voice, which is bullshit, you know, is what caused her show to come back. Like, no one was really clamoring that hard for a Roseanne comeback, you know? But my cynical take on it is that after the initial kind of excitement for some folks about the reboot had worn off and people realized, like, actually, this shit is not that funny and she is odious, viewership had gone down sufficiently that perhaps ABC was like, we're going to have to unload this, you know? And so this was, it just felt so businesslike and perfunctory. Like, there's no way in which I felt like, oh, wow, ABC is taking a stand. Y'all can fuck off. Also, the people who worked on that show, and I'm thinking specifically of like people who are above the line, not necessarily crew members, although, you know, y'all knew what you were getting into too. But folks above the line, the John Goodmans, the Laurie Metcalfs, I don't want to hear shit from y'all. I don't want to hear shit. You know, it wasn't like you were in a cave. You didn't know who you were working with. So to hear these people come at it now, like, this is beyond the pale. You know, this is unacceptable. What is it about this particular racist statement that was too much for you, as opposed to all the other racist shit she said before? Bye. Yeah, miss me.
Absolutely. And in other sort of borderline TV show cancellation news, so Samantha Bee made a joke about Ivanka Trump, in which she used, the worst word you can use in the United States, I guess, basically. The thing about this story that is interesting to me, that is so unprecedented, is that you literally now have the White House, tweeting right. and like campaigning actively for the cancellation of Samantha Bee, mm-hmm. which, for the president, a branch of the United States government to do that. And it's interesting because so many of the people on the right, the diehard Trump supporters, consider themselves diehard, like, quote unquote, anti-censorship people, right. diehard, like, First Amendment people. And yet, like, this comes closer mm-hmm. to censorship because it is, a government authority, at least sort of crusading for the cancellation, lobbying for the cancellation of a show. This comes closer to actual censorship than basically everything that people on the right tend to rail, use the word censorship to rail against, right? Like when creative people make decisions to include certain types of characters in their media instead of others or what mm-hmm. have you.
Yeah, what's interesting is when you introduced this section, you said like the worst word, right? Like you didn't actually use the term in the way that we don't use, we say like the N-word, right? Mm-hmm. So there are certain words which, based upon the ways in which they're received. And we have to be culturally specific here, right? Because if we were in like the UK or something, I don't think we would be shy at all about using the term, And so it was funny to see people, across social media, because, that's where I get my news, from like, England and stuff, being like, what is the issue? Why is everybody up in arms? But yeah. then the reaction here, right? And of course, I'm specifically interested in the way like so many Black female media personalities were like, there's something specific, like let's unpack why this word is like the worst word you can use for white women, but the way that Black women don't have that same attachment to that particular epithet, like that was the most interesting part of the discussion to me. I do not care, about right-wing, reactions, because they're so disingenuous. No. Like, give me a fucking break. Give me a fucking break. Trump, you need to sit this and several other things out. It was like when Roman Polanski decided to open his mouth about Me Too. Perhaps you should, lean back. Lean back. Yeah, don't lean in. Yeah. Lean back.
Yeah, there was a great tweet from the account that goes by Thomas Violence, I think, where he said something like, I love little cultural differences, like how, in the West, in the United States, you're so offended by this particular word. Well, here in Australia, we're offended by the murder of young children.
Yeah, it was like, exactly.
Who, obviously, like, in our work, like, we have to acknowledge that language can matter and language does have power. So it's not like it makes sense to never be upset at the use of certain words in certain contexts. But still, the point was well taken that as a culture, sometimes our priorities are a little skewed.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. All right. Let's move on from that. Although I am very interested, like I said, in the discussions that have been happening about like what words we can't even say, that we have trouble saying. I am very interested in this. So, I'll continue to hit us up on Twitter. Well, actually, let me not even say that, because the trolls are going to come out and just deluge our inbox with, the C word. So, well, too late, I guess, unless Wonderfell can Frankenstein that clip out of the show. I'm just asking for trolling at this point. But seriously, though, let's move on to a movie that I know that you loved so much, Carolyn. You couldn't wait to talk about it. Ron Howard's latest entry into the Star Wars franchise, Solo.
Ron Howard, just to start with, Ron Howard is like, he occasionally makes a decent film. Mm-hmm. But as a director, I find his style, just generally speaking, so bland and so just kind of like workmanlike, you know, so cinematically like uninteresting that I'm like, Ron Howard directing a Star Wars movie. So
yeah, has anyone ever said like, oh, I'm so excited for the new Ron Howard movie?
Right,
you know,
right, right.
I mean,
yeah.
You do know what you're gonna get, right? So it can scratch an itch, you know. As I was watching the movie, because I just saw it last night, I was like, this movie is not good. I'm enjoying myself, but it's like enjoying yourself the way when you're eating like a grilled cheese sandwich. You know exactly what you're getting. You're not going to be surprised by it. It's not going to be nutritious in any way. It's not going to give you anything. And you recognize as you're eating it that maybe you could be eating something better. But I was like, yeah, you know, Ron Howard, he knows how to pace a movie. I will say I thought the pacing of the movie was great, but I wasn't surprised by anything. I could have walked out at any point and I would have been just fine with it.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely took issue with the way that the Star Wars franchise seems to be inching into a much less interesting kind of storytelling to me.
Oh,
and
totally.
That is a kind of storytelling where it's more about making those, hey, this is how that happened, or hey, this is where this comes from, connections, than it is about developing character and telling stories that are compelling and interesting in and of themselves. So this movie, you know, it answers, oh, we know how he got the nickname Solo. We know how
he did the Kessel Run in 12 parsecs.
Exactly, exactly. And that to me is the most, like, egregious of all of these, because it involves, so there's this character, a droid named L337, voiced by Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who is great. Like, if you saw Fleabag, you know, that was her. She's also currently a writer and producer on Killing Eve, which I've been hearing nothing but fantastic things about. We talked about the first episode. I need to catch up on that. But so let's talk about this character a bit, because she is a like radical revolutionary droid who's sort of campaigning loudly and proudly for like equal rights for droids. And yet to me, like, obviously she's kind of a likable character. Like, the audience is, you know, we're kind of supposed to think she's like, you know, like, we want to root for her and everything, but also she's also presented as kind of ridiculous. Like, you have this moment where she and Lando are in the cockpit of the Falcon and, you know, Lando's leaving, and he's like, can I get you anything? And she says, equal rights. And Lando kind of, like, rolls his eyes at this a little bit or something. It's like this kind of joke moment, and I'm like, okay, this is weird, because,
yeah,
like, are we supposed to think that her crusade for equal rights is not worthy of this kind of fervent, like, devotion and dedication and focus that she puts on it? Like, and I mean, it's like, obviously, it's this weird, I don't know, it's this weird thing where the droids aren't, like, stand-ins for any, like, particular group, but they seem to be kind of like, oh, any maybe oppressed group could be them. But there was just something that resonated for me a little bit with it being Donald Glover, who just kind of made this video, This is America, who's playing this character who's kind of, like, so over his droid companion friend's, like, tireless crusade for droid equal rights. Like, just get over it already. Just shut up.
Yeah, there was this, you know, this whole, like, Dobby the house elf thing going on with L3, right? You know, so, you know, in a way that we haven't really talked. Okay, let me back up here. I am a Star Wars fan. I've, you know, seen all the movies, you know, well, I've seen all the movies I give a shit about multiple times, the prequels maybe a couple times each, and I'm not going back. But I'm deliberately not talking about things like the expanded universe, the Clone Wars, any of the novels, whatever, right? I'm talking specifically about the movies. We haven't really reckoned with, like, the kind of hierarchical nature of the films, you know, in the films themselves, right? So the way that the droids are owned by people, which would not be as notable a problem. It would still be a problem, but it would not be as notable a problem if the films did not give those droids personalities, right? As if to suggest that there's some sort of sapience involved, some manner of sentience,
yeah,
right?
Which it absolutely does.
Yeah, you know, and which is just amplified in this film. And there was a moment where I was like, you know what, Star Wars, I'm kind of done with the sassy droids trope that, you know, they insert into every film, like, you know, the kind of wisecracking droid, you know, like I'm kind of tired of their version of it. But if you are going to do that, if you are going to invest these droids with that kind of inner life and personality, then L3's, you know, position, her desire for freedom makes absolute sense. So,
exactly.
It doesn't deserve the level of, like, dismissiveness that it receives from Lando.
And the way that arc ends up to me is just, like, so... In the context of who L3 is and what she wants, it's so, like, sort of metaphysically horrifying, because what happens is that she, you know, in this sort of battle that she foments, she is sort of blasted to bits and she's, like, fading, you know, she's dying. And so but she has this, like, amazing navigational computer, or, like, she has better navigational data than any droid in the universe or whatever. And so they take her, like, whatever, her intellect, her consciousness, I don't know what you want to call it, her soul, you know, and they, like, merge it with the Falcon, so it seems to me basically like her soul, or her, so that she has basically been, like, now enslaved in some way by this, like, ship, and like, we're this, like, it just seems like such a reactionary, like, fate. How do you write that as a writer, you know, yeah, Kasdan's, without thinking, like, wow, this right, is, like, really fucked up.
How long is her spirit, her essence in the Falcon? Like, are we to assume that, like, the Millennium Falcon we see in later movies has her spirit
100%.
In it, right? And that she doesn't even have, like, Lando doesn't even live on the, doesn't even own the Falcon anymore. So this, like, important relationship has been, like, she no longer even has access to her good friend.
Exactly. And this is what I mean, too, by the kind of storytelling that this franchise is seeping into, is now, like, now when we watch, like, you know, A New Hope or Return of the Jedi or whatever, and the Falcon makes some, like, incredible jump to light speed, there's supposed to be some thing in the back of our minds, like, hey, that's L3. That's L3 doing that. Even, you know, she's never mentioned again. She's never, like, but, and it's like, that to me is just not interesting storytelling at all. And I want to talk too about, there's a reveal at the end of this film.
Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
They were on Earth all along.
That functions on a similar level for me. So I'm going to spoil the end of the movie now, everybody. There's a sort of...
you didn't spoil the movie. Ron Howard spoiled the end of the movie.
But there's what's meant to be a kind of shocking reveal at the end, where Emilia Clarke's character... you know, we find out that Paul Bettany, who was this crime boss, like, his boss the whole time has been none other than Darth Maul. And the reason this was so infuriating to me is that, like, okay, I know that people who follow all the extended universe stuff know that Maul was alive, right? But to those of us, like, but the movies should work as self-contained movies. And to those of us like me who don't really follow that stuff, it wasn't like a, what? Darth Maul's alive? Whoa, cool, mind blown thing. It was more like, huh? Like, what? He got cut in half and fell down into the reactor. Like, he's, what? I don't understand. So that was, it just was not a good, to me, it was a very frustrating storytelling choice. And I just see that indicating the path that these films are going to continue going down, of, like, creating these just more and more intricate connections to each other and prioritizing that over telling compelling stories about the characters that the movie is actually about.
I have never been more convinced in a film that the film was being written as it was being filmed.
Right.
You know, there was a very real sense in which, as the movie was progressing, I felt like, oh, and now they're going to throw, you know, there's this giant space octopus, and now there's going to be another conversation about oppression. And there was a very interesting moment when, I'm blanking on the name of the character, Ifsness, whoever the marauders were that that Woody Harrelson's character was, you know, kind of being chased by, and who were set up as his main rivals. When the head person pulls her mask off, and it's this beautiful beautiful young woman, and she looked mixed race to me, and I was like, mm-hmm. oh, wait, is that going to turn out to be his daughter? You know, like with Thandi Newton's character? And I was like, aww. Okay, that's very interesting, but y'all have gone through too far into this movie to be setting this shit up now, you know? And of course, then we don't pick up that particular narrative thread, but I very much felt like as the movie was going on, like, it was being written. Like, they were getting the pages as they were filming.
Right. I mean, it was like, yeah. First of all, you reminded me how frustrated I was of how this film, I mean, squandered the presence of Thandi Newton. I know you're not a big fan of hers, but just, like, narratively, how much more interesting would it have been early on the Woody Harrelson character had been the one, you know, or, like, the white guy character had been the one who died, mm-hmm. and then the black woman was put in the sort of de facto place of like the head of this like ragtag bunch of of scoundrels and criminals, right? Like just so typical, like so predictable.
But of course, like they're never going to do that in Star Wars, right? Because Star Wars, you know, I mean, at its essence, is all about fathers, right? You know, like bad fathers, good fathers. So, you know, this is just, but like you say, it's just one more entry, you know, into that shit sandwich, you know, one more layer of it that we didn't particularly need. The thing that most got me about this film is how there were absolutely no stakes. And this is inherent to prequels, right? Because you know Han makes it out. You know Han doesn't end up with Kira. You know, sure. you know, that obviously the character Tobias Beckett that Han is allied with in this film doesn't play a major role later in his life, so something must happen to him. Like, we already know what happens to these characters, and so there's a way in which I just was not invested because I felt like, okay, this story has been told before. This is something that probably would work great if in a Star Wars novel, you know, where these backstories could be unfolded in an interesting way. But as a film, I'm just not interested in this.
See, I mean, I sort of disagree in the sense that, like, I can get, you know, so the stakes are so high in the main trilogy, right? Mm-hmm. Of like that the fate of the whole galaxy is at stake, right? If this film had been like had kept it like really small and intimate, had been like about say just like a heist, but like a, mm-hmm. like a heist movie in the classic sense of like just a really focused, you know, heist movie or whatever, like the one job kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I could have gotten really into that because it would have been just this like self-contained, but still like formative and illuminating mm-hmm. story about Han Solo before he got in, you know, before he got tangled up in the rebellion. But, you know, it didn't work as a pure like heist movie because it kept trying to make these reaches for the mm-hmm. the larger lore and the larger stakes of Star Wars, and so that to me was a kind of miscalculation. Like I think mm-hmm. that if this had been a very uncharacteristic Star Wars film and been even like smaller and tighter and more like intimate, it mm-hmm. could have like that could have been a really interesting direction to go in.
Yeah, absolutely. There are two things I want to cover before we have to move on into a discussion of the Terminator. One is I said the thing that bothered me the most is that the film didn't have any stakes. That's not actually accurate. The thing that bothered me the most is that the elements of the narrative that did have the most stakes were so clumsily handled. And I'm thinking specifically of, like, I don't want to get into, you know, like, poking holes in the logic of the film, because we'll be here all fucking day. But the crew that Han is part of, this kind of de facto, you know, like family of pirates that he joins, excuse me, is tasked with stealing this hyperfuel, this coaxium, right? And they can't steal refined coaxium. It's too difficult. So they make a plan to steal unrefined coaxium from this planet, during which we get, you know, L3's, you know, kind of revolutionary blossoming. And then they have to take it to a place where it can be refined, right? And okay, my first question is, if coaxium is so incredibly valuable, I felt like even a non-imperial outpost where that shit gets refined would probably be more built up and more fortified than the essentially like desert outpost they take it to, which is just like a small town gas station. But the thing that really fucked me up about that place was that it is peopled with overwhelmingly brown people, black people, right? And these sort of like pseudo, you know, I'm using the word in quotation marks, tribal colors and patterns. And I was just like, you mean to tell me in a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away in this universe which we have created of all the ways that you could have depicted this, once again, it's brown people who are at the bottom of the totem pole, it's eking out an existence, a hard scrabble existence, waiting for white saviors to come and deliver them.
Yeah.
Fuck all the way off.
Yeah. And the film isn't even concerned with them or their fate, really. It's just like an easy visual shorthand, I think, for white audiences of, like, poor oppressed people. Okay, but back to Han and like his adventures.
Fuck off.
Yeah.
There's that, but then okay, let's talk about the casting before we wrap up.
Okay.
So as much as I felt like this movie was by the numbers, it gave you exactly what it was on the 10, I could take it or leave it. There were some fantastic performances in it. So obviously, people talk about Donald Glover, you know, capturing kind of the roguish charm of Lando. And he absolutely does. Paul Bettany, I think, plays a fantastic villain. Like, that dude, there's just something menacing about him.
Very,
you know,
chilling.
That is fantastic. Thandie Newton, who, as you've said, I don't love, but she's great in this. And I probably will be trying to cosplay as her. But Alden Ehrenreich, the lead of the movie. I couldn't even be mad. I was just bored. I was just bored by him. There was nothing about him that made me think for even one second, this is Han Solo.
Yeah, his acting style seemed to be like it was like he noted certain like little mannerisms or tics that Harrison Ford did in the original trilogy and kind of tried to like replicate those or work them into his performance, but without getting any of the like the actual kind of presence of the character, right? It was a very rote kind of performance that didn't internalize the character at all. So
and I felt like, you know what, there's a way in which I might have enjoyed this film more if it were not pitched as a Han Solo origin picture, but if it had been, you know, modified somewhat and it was about just another character in the Star Wars universe, you know, but that wasn't burdened with the baggage of trying to be like Han Solo. In the same way that, like, you don't cover Aretha Franklin or Tina Turner or Janis Joplin because you'll never be able to reach those heights, I just don't see anyone successfully, doing, you know, Harrison Ford cosplay.
There was a throwaway reference to Bosch in this film. Make it the origin story of Bosch, who we only see for like 2 seconds in The Empire Strikes Back. That, you know, movie saved.
Seriously.
All right.
Let us move on to the Terminator.
From one robot, it's a tale of two robots today. From one robot to another.
Oh my God. I cannot wait to talk about this movie. In fact, I'm so excited to talk about it. I probably will lose all coherent, well, what little manner of coherent thought I have. I have pages of notes. And yet, so much of it boils down to, I had forgotten that Paul Winfield and Lance Henriksen were in this movie because I hadn't seen it in so long.
Yeah.
And I almost did a lap around my living room when I was rewatching it. I was delighted to see them. I would watch a 6-season TV series about them as cops in LA in the 80s.
I was going to say the same thing. Like, the film, like, it gives them enough. It knows what it has as an asset in these two actors. Mm-hmm. And so it gives them enough, little moments of character development that their presence means something in the film. Even though they, of course, both meet, like, when they're offed by the Terminator along with, like, every other cop in the station, you know, like, the film has to just keep move on without a second thought for them. But while they're there, they, you know, they're so great. And
so great.
I totally would have, like, they're the kind of, you know, sort of, like, overworked, underpaid, like, you know, cigarette smoking, coffee drinking, you know, slightly cynical, but also, like, concerned, genuinely concerned you know, like those are you write a novel about cops like that, or you put them in a TV series or whatever, and I'm like, I'm all in.
Absolutely. And I find it particularly interesting. So plug time. When you and I talked about LA Confidential on a past episode of Cinema Ball, a lot of our discussion was about the kind of filmic construction of a world of men in the LAPD, right? And that's what we have here, but it's very like, there's a way in which it's very specifically 1980s, and yet it's also timeless in the way that like cops are just gonna be cops. They're always gonna be cops. You could plonk these two guys down in LA Confidential, and they have the same kind of rapport that the cops in LA Confidential had. So yeah, that I absolutely love that. So Terminator, right? So it comes out in 1984. I think it is incredibly important for us to think about what's going on in 1984 or the early 80s, right, with Reagan in the White House, and the kind of films that come out, the kind of media that obtains during that period, but also Arnold Schwarzenegger specifically. So Arnold, you know, kind of bursts onto the American pop cultural scene in the late 70s as a bodybuilding champion. And he's called specifically a Germanic machine. Right. So it's I find it fascinating that this is the person who's chosen to embody the Terminator, who is literally a cyborg, who is, you know, literally man and machine together, and why that figure becomes so fascinating to us that it then spawns multiple movies, a TV show, comic books, novels, etc., right? Because, you know, in 1984, when this movie comes out, no one's thinking like, oh yeah, I mean, they're not thinking in the way that we think of franchises today. You know, no one is thinking like, oh yeah, 35 years from now, they're going to be starting, they're going to reboot this, and not even reboot it from number one, but reboot it from number three, you know? But what is it about Arnold as the Terminator that we latch onto?
I was reminded when I was watching the film last night of, I mean, it really is, in my view, a fantastic performance, because it's pure physicality. It is pure movement. And you know, say what you will about Arnold's, like, acting chops, as, you know, in other areas. But at this point in his life, he was so able to move with a kind of mechanical focus and, you know, he just looms so large on camera. And there's something, so like, you have these images where, you know, he goes to the home of the first ill-fated Sarah Connor. And, you know, he just busts her door open and the camera, you just see the camera. And there's just no expression on his face whatsoever, other than like the default kind of like, you know, menace, but it's part of what makes it menacing is the lack of any like humanity really in it, or any like particular emotion. And it just like, I feel like this is, I think that this film is expertly constructed. I think it is a fantastic piece of cinema, and to me it is borderline like a horror film, because, you know, the Terminator is like the relentless, just, you know, unstoppable killing machine.
Oh, it is legitimately terrifying when the organic covering of the Terminator is finally burned away, and his metal skeleton is still moving and actively towards Sarah Connor. Like 34, 35 years later, you know, you're watching this movie and you're still terrified, because you know it will not stop.
Yeah, like there's a moment where, so this the tanker, this gas tanker blows up, which is what sheds the last of the skin from the Terminator, and you see the skeleton kind of in the flames, and you see this sort of skull-like visage turn towards Sarah, and it's almost as if within the flames you can sort of see the last of the flesh burning off. And it's this, it is such an image of horror, of like unstop, of just like death itself, almost, in the sense of how it starts at that point to look like a skeleton, you know, coming after you. I had never, I don't, I mean, I don't think I'd ever registered before. There's a line that happens a little earlier in the film where the Terminator is staying at some, you know, flea bag motel or something. And a guy, the cleaning guy, you know, janitor or whatever, says, like, knocks on the door and says, like, you got a dead cat in there or something, pal. I'd never registered before that, oh, the flesh on the Terminator is actually starting to rot. Like, that is what's happening. Like, that is... ugh, like that is horrifying in and of itself.
Yeah, and you know, other horror tropes that this movie plays with are, and this is not, you know, belabored in any way, so I don't wish to belabor it myself, but the sort of contrasting of the legitimate female victim versus illegitimate female victim. So you have Sarah Connor, our Sarah Connor,
right,
is roommates with a woman named Ginger, who is dating the... lovely to see Rick Rossovich, which were he, you know, in his early 30s today, the year of our Lord 2018, he absolutely would be Chris Pratt. He would have Chris Pratt's career, you know?
Yeah.
But so she's very much like the sexual bodied feminine, you know, and she is dispatched, you know, violently in the film. And
right,
she is set up as the contrast to Sarah Connor, who's, you know, it certainly is not dowdy or plain, but, you know, is more covered up, is, you know, not presented as, you know, a sexual object of desire in the same way. And obviously, the movie has to set Sarah up this way because she is literally the mother of the future, right?
Yeah.
Like, film, her primary importance as the future incubator of the savior of mankind.
JC, John Connor,
that's
Jesus
right.
Christ, James Cameron.
Oh my God, Carol, we are peeling back the layers of this cinematic onion. People, we're absolutely not ready. So obviously I'm super interested in what happens I love when we can talk about old movies so we don't have to worry about spoiling shit, right? I mean, even if you haven't seen the Terminator films, you know that, you know, a Terminator is sent back from, you know, the Skynet-ruled future to kill the mother of John Connor, who is going to lead the rebellion, the successful rebellion against the machines, right? So I am fascinated by what happens between the first Terminator film and then the second Terminator film, in the transformation of Sarah Connor's character, you know? We know physically what happens to her. Like, she becomes so buff, so tough, right? And she becomes fiercer in a way, but she becomes something much more than just the incubator, than just the mother, although that is still her primary mission. But having said that, as fascinated as I am by what is done with the character of Sarah Connor, again, I can't get away from Arnold Schwarzenegger and the vision of hypermasculinity that we get in this film, right? So our first image of Arnie in this film, the Terminator, we see him come back through time, and there's lightning all around him, and then we see him in this classical pose.
Yes.
Right? And it is this perfect body. We are meant to appraise it and to kind of cherish the image of this perfect body. And we don't yet know that inside the flesh is a machine. And so I'm really interested in what this film, in this period, like I said, during the Reagan era, what this says about, like, Arnold Schwarzenegger, who is known to this point, you know, like his movie career is getting started, but he is not yet the action hero that he will become later in the 80s and in the 90s. Still is known primarily from his bodybuilding days for his body, right? So, like, what version or what does hypermasculinity in this period, what does it require to be recognizable and of use to the state apparatus? Because he is literally sent back by the machines to preserve one version of the state. And Kyle Reese, who is his rival, goes back to prevent that future and ensure another version of the state. But like the body as a tool of the state. Like, it's just fascinating to me because body culture in this period becomes this juggernaut, you know, like gyms are popping up everywhere and just like working on your body becomes this huge thing. And we are encouraged to be fascinated by Arnold Schwarzenegger and his morphology, even when it's covered up, just like the sheer size of him, you know, and to know that like a body that looks like this is capable of anything.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the level of sort of physical icon, an icon of masculinity, as you say, that he reached, particularly during the Reagan era, obviously for some time after that, but particularly in those like 80s pictures, I mean, was staggering. You're right. He was like this cultural ideal, like almost the borderline, the unattainable ideal of masculinity.
And so, it's really interesting that he is Austrian, right?
Right.
You know, and he looks the way he does. He's got, like, he's not conventionally handsome by any means, you know? He's got that gap tooth, you know, smile and whatever. And so, you know, I've laughed about this before, specifically in relation to James Cameron and the movie Aliens and Lance Henriksen, who we get in this movie. God, I love Lance Henriksen. But I love the idea that these machines or people in the future are creating these like incredibly advanced cyborgs or androids, and the versions they are choosing to use looks like either Arnold Schwarzenegger in The Terminator or Lance Henriksen in Aliens, right? Like, of all the physical forms you can take, kills me. But I mean, with Arnold Schwarzenegger, you get it, right? Because it's not about him being attractive. It is about him being powerful and him being single-minded, and his body conveys that. And it harkens back to, like I said, this kind of classical idea of the body as a tool of the state, and how bodies that have been rigorously fashioned are better citizens because they are not, you know, afflicted with like lassitude or, you know, moral laxity.
Right. There were crowd shots, and there were shots in this film of, say, Kyle Reese walking through parts of downtown Los Angeles, and like, you know, maybe the only white face in the shot, you know, and so it's like, oh, it's authentically representing the, like, what a crowd, the diversity of Los Angeles, and yet it also calls to, it spotlights how much, not only this film, but then going into the future of the franchise, where you get Robert Patrick as the T-1000, and so on, like, the way that it's centered whiteness to such a degree, like, all, like, why wouldn't, in from the resistance, why wouldn't some of the Terminators be of, you know, other skin tones? Why wouldn't some of the heroes be of other skin tones? It's like, it's very, I think with our perspective of from today, it's very easy to see how this film kind of like actively centers whiteness.
I mean, because like you say, like Robert Patrick, right? Like the T-1000 version that he represents, he's made of that liquid metal that, you know, essentially can shapeshift into any form, can take on the form of anyone. We see him, you know, take on the form of occasionally other people, but he's primarily Robert Patrick, you know, like this white dude. He's not someone else.
Right, and we'll talk about that more, I think, when we talk about Terminator 2 in a future episode. But I mean, there is stuff to talk about with the fact that his persona in throughout most of the film is a cop, right? Like, that's pretty interesting. But I want to quickly say about The Terminator, which is, you know, a film that I think is functions absolutely as like a sci-fi horror, not, you know, I don't want to specifically call it horror, but like a sci-fi thriller classic. I really love the special effects in this film.
Oh, me too.
Like,
give it up for Stan Winston, everybody.
Yeah, Stan Winston, exactly. Like, there's so much great work in this film with miniatures and with stop motion animation. And it's, you know, it's just interesting to me. Like, obviously, you can tell what's happening in the film. You can see, like, oh, that's being projected on a screen, and, you know, whatever, like, you have the live actors in front of the screen or whatever the trick, quote unquote, trick is. And yet, like, there's a little bit of joy and admiration that I feel when watching these kinds of special effects from the past, where you can see the workmanship and see the craft, as opposed to, like, I mean, movies today, like Solo or whatever, like, yeah, I mean, there's a special effects extravaganza. There's this whole, like, extremely elaborate sequence with some, like, black hole type thing in space and, like, giant creatures or whatever. And, I mean, obviously a lot of work goes into something like that, but I'm never going to go, like, oh, I really like these special effects in particular, because they don't have anything that sets them apart from the special effects in any other major motion picture nowadays. It's like it all looks the same. It's all CGI or whatever. And so,
and the reality is those images start to degrade over time. So as you watch them become, they become more and more, you know, unreal, to use an unwieldy term, in a way that this film does not, that Aliens does not, just to, you know, like,
yeah,
I don't want to act like, you know, I worship at the altar of James Cameron, but the fact is, Aliens, Terminator, The Abyss, which is a film that I was gonna make Carol watch for Cinema Ball, but then wisely chose not to.
I like The Abyss.
Yeah, there's a way in which those movies do not betray their origins in the same way, because there is a tactility to them. And as you say, you know, there's so much care is put into those effects. So, which is not to say that, like, their version of the future is more real than, you know, some CGI version of the future. But there is, you know, there is such care taken with the construction of that world that it feels more weighty. There's something more to hold on to.
It's like, there's a certain, I mean, what I think of or characterize of, perhaps like very incorrectly, but as like a working class swagger to a film like The Terminator, which feels so gritty and so just like shot on location, fairly low budget, you know, everything. It just feels more rooted in a reality that you can reach out and touch. That, and as the budget of films goes up and up, they become more, they tend to become more sterile or just less, they just feel less, the lighting becomes more artificial, everything about them becomes somehow like more overproduced, like more refined in a way that diminishes character to a large degree.
Yeah, you know, they're slicker, right? Like the surface has been smoothed out. Even James Cameron stuff, right? Like,
100%.
Like Avatar, you know?
Oh, God.
So he's absolutely moved away from some of the things that made his movies something that you can latch into and hold on to. I cannot wait for us to talk more about the Terminator franchise in subsequent episodes. I really want to get into Terminator 2, and I promise I'll talk more about them as films and not just excuses for me to, you know, trip merrily down academic lane. but talk about Terminator 2. And I'm looking forward to watching some of the Sarah Connor Chronicles, which I did not watch when it was on, but I know is a particular favorite of Anita's. Although I'm sure there are elements of it that she would like to unpack, but I'm really excited to talk about that. And also Terminator 3, when I think it's Terminator 3, when the Terminator who was sent back is feminine bodied, right? Is female bodied. Like, what's up with that? Anyway.
Yeah. We'll get to that when we get to it.
Yeah. I love it. What's your deal? What's your deal?
What's your deal?
Okay, so Carolyn.
Yeah.
What is your deal?
My deal this week, my freak out this week. Hey, Anita, I've got your back, Anita.
I don't.
I'm 100% on your side, Anita. Right? I'm your favorite, right, Anita? I mentioned this back when the season started, and I'm going to mention it one last time. Now that the season and the show have ended, so The Americans just wrapped its final season, and I was so impressed by how consistently excellent this final season was. It was so. This is a show that has The Americans. It's a show where it stars Kerry Russell and Matthew Rhys as Russian spies living in deep cover as a quote-unquote normal American family. It's a show that has always had, I think, it's one of the great TV portrayals of a marriage, in my view, taken as a whole, as a series, because of how it deals with communication or lack of communication, trust or lack of trust, like all these things that are part of every sort of marriage or to some degree or relationship, whether they're, and it's just fascinating. You know, it's somewhat, sometimes people criticize the show for being somewhat slow, but I actually really appreciate that it is a rather slow show in the sense that it really takes the time to develop its characters, and that the spycraft stuff is in service of the character development and the themes and everything, rather than the characters and all that being in service of these occasional bits of like exciting spycraft or whatever. I mean, it all comes together so well. But it's hard to talk about too much without spoiling things. So I'll just say, like, if you have never been on the Americans train before, like the final season, I think elevates the show, and the finale, also in particular, you know, elevates the show to it sticks the landing is what I'm trying to say. Like if the ending had been bad, obviously it could have diminished the show to some degree as a whole. But I now that it's a complete work that I can look back on in its entirety and see how the themes are, you know, are certain themes are woven throughout it, and how things toward the end circle back to things toward the beginning. I'm just in awe of the work that the creators and writers and actors did on this show. Carrie Russell is fantastic. And so, yeah, it's one of my all-time favorite shows for sure, and I encourage folks to check it out.
You know, I did not watch The Americans, but I read a bunch of pieces online about the final episode, and so many writers shared your sentiments about how wonderful the series was, but then like this kind of tonally perfect finale. And I had a moment where I was so sad for you, because I was like, it's like Halt and Catch Fire, like Caro's favorite shows ended. I know all things end, you know, and you know, rather than sort of continue to unspool things, you know, to lesser and lesser effect, it's yes. Better to have, you know, these contained stories. But still, I was like, oh, you know, it's one more of her favorite shows is yeah. Now over.
I mean, I'm 100% glad they you know, this was the way it should have gone out. I'm mm-hmm. glad they ended it when they did and how they did. Yeah. So, you know, let's just hope that Killing Eve can fill the TV void in my heart now that The Americans is over.
Oh, my God. I have caught up with the season. I cannot wait for season two. We'll leave it at that. I have a very brief deal / freak out. It's actually probably more of a freak out this week. So I was rereading a book that I loved from my childhood and had not read since I was probably 10 years old, The Borrowers by Mary Norton, who was an English writer, actor, and The Borrowers came out in, I want to say, the early 50s. It is about a family of tiny people who live within the floor of this, you know, rather ornate, stately home that has very few occupants anymore. And as their name suggests, they survive by borrowing items from the big people, or the human beings, as they call them.
So
they would use like, you know, buttons as plates or thimbles as mixing bowls. And it was such a charming series. I believe I read all of them. I think there's four or five in the entire series. The last one came out in the 80s, actually.
Wow.
But I just remember how delighted I was by the way the author had constructed this alternate fantastical world of the borrowers, and how she expertly thought of everything. You know, it was just so imaginatively constructed. And it was very much, you know, something that I had no, like, obviously not English, obviously don't come from a position of, like, you know, I'm not a landed gentry. I have never been in a stately home. And so just the way that she puts us into this very genteel world, but like faded gentility, shabby gentility, and the way that the borrowers make use of these wonderful things, especially like the doll furniture. I just loved it. So I reread it this weekend. And as I said, I hadn't read it since I was about 10 years old. And I was pulled up in a way that I was not when I was 10, because I'm sure I glossed over it entirely. But the main character of The Borrowers is one of the borrowers. She's a 13-year-old girl named Arietti, and her mother's name is Homily. And she's kind of a, you know, very warm-hearted but kind of flighty woman. And in a moment of, like, you know, kind of anxiety, the author talks about her being able to kind of settle down before bed, and she's endlessly walking the floor, and she decides to curl her hair. And she does this with curling rags, and so she, you know, curls her hair with these curling rags, and the description says she looked like a gollywog.
Okay.
Which completely pulled me up, because if you don't know, a gollywog is a racist toy. It is a doll with black skin and, you know, like exaggerated, you know, red lips, sometimes white lips. You can think of like the minstrelsy, right? But in doll form and, you know, kind of yarn hair. And people will debate endlessly whether gollywogs are racist. They are still sold in many countries, and people will fight for their right to have them. It's like, you know, fighting for the right to have, like, you know, a lawn jockey. But I was pulled up by it. And like I said, I don't remember this from my childhood. And I'm sure when I was 10, I didn't even know what a gollywog was. And so I just passed over that word. But it made me think about the ways in which certain children can never completely relax into media, because you never know when you're going to be hit in the face with something like this, with casual homophobia, you know, casual transphobia, casual racism. You can never let go and completely sink into something. And it just made me so sad, because I weep for anyone who has that experience and so has to put things away, or who can never be completely unguarded, who can never, you know, kind of put their hearts into the hands of a creator, because you never know when you're going to be let down in that way.
Absolutely. And you know? That's part of, I mean, certainly as a, you know, in my own ways as a trans person growing up when I knew that I was trans, and even older, like, you know, that was an issue to me for some degree. And, you know, that's part of why I think the work we do is so important, right? Is we want that every child to be able to have that experience of entering, projecting themselves into media, into heroic characters, without that need to be vigilant, be on guard, be like only half opening to the experience, because they don't know where or when the next little cut is going to come from.
Exactly. So that is my deal for the week, and that is our show for the week. You can catch us back here every single Wednesday. Remember that you can also join our podcast community and help us bring you another sousson of sassiness of content every single week at d.rip/femfreak. If you are enjoying the show, and y'all, you know you are, please leave us a review on iTunes, because it really helps spread the word about our show. And tell your friends. You can check out all of our work and all of our other podcasts at feministfrequency.com. So be sure to follow us on Twitter @FemFreak to stay up to date on all the news. We always want to hear from you, unless you're going to troll us. So don't do that. So hit us up on Twitter @FemFreak and let us know what you'd like to hear us talk about on Feminist Frequency Radio. I promise Anita and Carolyn will take those suggestions under advisement. I won't. I have my own ideas. You can find us on Twitter. Anita is @AnitaSarkeesian. I am @AmericanBodyCulture. And Carol, where are you?
I am @CarolynMichelle.
Awesome. Our producer is Phil Circus, who also composed our theme music. Hey, hey, Wonder Phil. We will see you all next week.
Later.
Bye-bye.